This is Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield.
Thanks for joining me. Before we get to today's program, I just wanted to mention that Theory of Change is part of the Flux Media Network. So go to flux.community for more podcasts and articles about politics, religion, media, and society, and how they all intersect. And if you want to go to the archives of this program, just go to theoryofchange.show, where you can get the video, audio, and transcript of all the episodes. And my special thanks to everybody who is a paid subscribing member. You can do that on Substack or Patreon, whichever one you prefer. And if you are a paid subscriber, you have complete unlimited access to all of the content. So thank you very much for everybody who's doing that. But we also do have free subscriptions as well, if you cannot afford to do that at this time. And if you wouldn't mind subscribing on YouTube as well, if you're watching over there, and make sure to click the notification icon to get notified when we're posting a new episode. That's very helpful. All right, so with that little preliminary out of the way, let's get into today's program. The past several episodes of Theory of Change have focused on dating and sex, and I wanted to end the miniseries with a conversation that brings in the topic of media as well. Not just because the next episode arc that we'll be doing is a look at the state of the media, but also because media have played an important role in how people meet and form connections for a lot longer than the internet existed. It seems forever ago now in 2024, but for many years, one of the primary ways that people found dates was through a local newspaper and their personal ads. You know the kinds. Single white females seeking men for tennis and deep conversations. And it wasn't just dating either, of course. Got a trip to Spain coming up? Learn Spanish from the comfort of your own home with one of our great tutors. And so on. Millions of short messages like these were the original social media feed for Americans and people of any other country. They were the place to figure out what the regular people around us were up to and what they were looking for. And as it happened, a lot of the time, at least some of those people were looking for sex workers. But strippers, escorts, and other such professionals weren't allowed to advertise in the respectable, quote-unquote, American daily newspapers. So instead, they turned to their local alternative newspaper, a new genre of newspaper that sprung up mostly after the Vietnam War and had continued in a much less lucrative fashion after that. But in the 90s and early 2000s, the alt-weeklies were in their heyday. They were bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the companies that ran them. They also produced a lot of great journalism, and the first real challenge to the bland and cowardly approach that even today dominates the mainstream media when it comes to politics and power. The story of the alternative newspaper and how the former counterculture became the mainstream one is one that my guest on today's episode tells in a new podcast series for Audible called Hold Fast. And joining me today to discuss is Sam Eifling. He is the co-host of Hold Fast, and it is about a chain of alternative newspapers that later turned into Backpage.com. So welcome to Theory of Change, Sam.
Thanks. Appreciate being here.
Yeah. Well, so I think a lot of people have never heard of Backpage.com at this point, and for a variety of reasons, whether age or being too young for it or not being interested in those types of services. So why don't we start off with saying what was Backpage.com, and then we'll Sure. get into where it came from.
The simplest way to describe Backpage is it was a knockoff of Craigslist, like a pure, just straight up Craigslist knockoff that eventually, because of the attitudes and past sort of business expertise of the owners, really became the go-to red light district for sex ads on the internet for the better part of a decade, really. It was a company that grew out of a company I used to work for. It was a newspaper company called New Times, Inc. When I started working there in the early 2000s, it was the biggest chain of alternative news weeklies in America, right? So these papers you would get, they were free. They were paid for by advertising. Display ads, which are usually what companies take out, and classified ads, which are what individuals mostly take out. Classified ads could be selling your couch, selling your car, asking help wanted ad. And part of the New Times model for a long time was to welcome and encourage ads that had a sort of a gray zone of sexuality, right? So it could be massages, it could be escorts. I'm sure there were working prostitutes advertising in the back pages of New Times papers and probably helping to pay my salary and that of other reporters. It really wasn't our business to focus on at the time, but as that model fell apart, as Craigslist came in especially and started disrupting the entire online classified ecosystem, and these papers started wondering, how are we going to get the money to pay for the journalism? Executives at New Times came up with the idea of essentially running the same style of ads that they ran in the papers online in a Craigslist-like format. And over the years, that became increasingly a lightning rod for attention and negative attention, especially when it came to people who would go to the media or appear in different venues and say, I was trafficked via Backpage. Someone held me against my will and advertised me as a prostitute, or at that point, a victim of a crime of sex trafficking on Backpage. And with a few of those accusations out of millions and millions of ads, there became this groundswell. The groundswell led to activism. The activism fed into political pressure. Political pressure led to the arrest of the main characters in our show, Michael Lacey and Jim Larkin, who years ago had started this chain of alternative news weeklies and now were being arrested by the FBI and charged with essentially facilitating prostitution at probably the largest scale that's ever been accused in the history of the U.S. government. They were basically saying, you guys are, in effect, the biggest pimps in the history of America. And they were thrown in jail and taken to trial. And so that's sort of where we picked up. Is the beginning of the show is the arrest of Lacey and Larkin. And by the end, we're at a federal trial to hear the government make their case against Backpage and the Backpage executives.
Yeah, it's a story that it's a really important story, more than you would think. I think for people who, you know, are like, oh, I would never place an adult classified ad, or I would never go to a prostitute or whatever. There's a lot of real implications to all this, both where they came from and the case against them. So let's maybe step back then to the beginning here. In 2024, it seems a world removed in many ways, this industry that these guys really kind of started, and of alternative newspapers. And a lot of this, I mean, it really got started with the Village Voice out of New York City in the 1950s. And then kind of there were a bunch of sort of self-styled underground newspapers that were kind of run by anti-war college students primarily in the 60s and 70s. And then it became a business with these guys. So why don't you tell us about that and what did they discover that people had missed?
Certainly, yeah. I think age is a big part of this. So I can just say I'm born in 1980. And when I was a college student thinking about getting into newspapers or journalism at all, newspapers were still really king, newspapers and magazines. And I think a lot of people did probably in that age, before there were blogs, before there were podcasts, you might think about starting your own paper, right? It was something you could write, you could print, you could report, you could have a voice, you could raise hell and distribute it. And that was a model that had been around for a long time. In the case of the Village Voice, it started in the mid-50s in New York and sort of set the template, right? Which was a paper that was adversarial to the entrenched power structures in the city, including the existing media, which I think was a big part of what I think anybody now who gets onto Twitter or a lot of, I don't know how many vlogs are picking apart the mainstream media. Well, that used to be the role of these kind of insurgent newspapers and news gathering organizations. But what made New Times different, what made New Times successful, was that they found a business model to go with it. So our protagonist of the show is a guy named Mike Lacey. Mike Lacey was a college student at Arizona State University in the early 70s, and he and a bunch of friends put together this anti-Vietnam War protest paper. At first, it was a collective. It was chaotically run, I'm sure with the ideals of the day in mind as they set up the business structure, which was basically no business structure at all. And when I worked at New Times, very famously, Mike Lacy would talk about having donated plasma in the early days to keep the paper going, right? These guys were broke. They're having fun. They're raising hell, but they were broke. Jim Larkin, who was not a journalist, but who really enjoyed journalism and appreciated good journalism, approached the paper sometime after it started and said, look, I think you guys have a really good thing going. I also think you don't know what you're doing on the business side. I have a lot of ideas. And essentially, Larkin didn't invent this model, but I think he ran it very well, which was to sell a lot of small ads in the paper that maybe were coming from businesses, sort of, they were selling these ads to businesses that were too small to advertise in the big daily, which was the Arizona Republic in Phoenix. So if you ran a very small business, or if you were if you were like a person giving guitar lessons, or you were a handyman, or you were the kind of seamstress who would patch up people's clothes, like this is the kind of stuff that you probably wouldn't place an ad in the daily, right? Like you might just put flyers around your neighborhood, but here comes this paper. The space is cheaper. You can buy small ads and you can participate in the community through your advertising, right? You have a platform effectively if you buy a little piece of this paper. The genius of classified ads, the key to classified advertising, well, there are really two. One, they are really small, but because they're small, you can sell them basically at a premium on the page. So if one page of advertising holds just one ad, that ad costs a lot of money. But if it holds 200 ads, collectively those 200 ads add up to a lot more money than you would charge for the one. It's more work to put them in. And also just, you know, it's like any kind of like parceling up of real estate, right? The smaller you cut it, the more you can sell, the more total sales value you're probably going to get out of it. So what happened in these papers, New Times especially, but The Voice did this, they could run literally thousands of these ads. And these ads were run by so many people from so many walks of life that no one advertiser really had editorial say over the paper, which was key. If you had one big ad and one big advertiser, that company, and it was always a company at that point, that company would expect to have some leverage against the paper, and they would. And in dailies, they did. Anywhere a big advertiser is funding a lot of the work of a journalism organization, they have a lot of say, whether the journalists even realize it or not, right? The owners make way for a big advertiser. If there are thousands and thousands of advertisers, if it's that democratic, that collective, and that many people are coming in, you can run a lot of material in the paper that could potentially piss a lot of them off. But you'll be fine, because if 10 people walk out, you don't really care, right? There's so many people advertising that it effectively creates this way of community support, financial support for a newspaper, a news venture. And New Times ran that model very well. They ran it in Phoenix, and then eventually they saw other weekly papers around the country. This is in the early mid-90s. Actually, I guess, yeah, the early mid-90s is really when they started to expand. And they saw other papers that maybe were doing good journalism, that had the instincts to cover their city really aggressively and to connect with a community of readers, but maybe they didn't have the business down. And so gradually, New Times started buying up these papers. They went to Denver, they went to Miami, they went to San Francisco, and where they went, they would buy a paper that maybe wasn't making as much money as it could. They would sort of install their software, a way of thinking of it, their business practices.
Their formula, yeah.
Their formula, which they took a lot of shit for over the years, like having a formula, but they became very financially successful. And through that, through a zillion teeny tiny ads, right, from people from every walk of life walking into the newspaper with up to the ad window, sometimes dictating an ad, sometimes having it written down. They were making, at the time, I guess, around 2005. They eventually merged. These companies merged, the Village Voice Company and New Times. And when those two companies merged, they created a company that had, even though Craigslist was eating into their business model at that stage. They had a combined revenue of almost $200 million a year. It was a giant company. And that was off of, I think, 17 papers. And so there was big money to be made, and it funded a lot of bare-knuckle journalism that just would not have any place, in many cases, at the daily papers, because it was just too unfriendly to kind of the ethos that most papers maintain to be the kind of like network TV of their city, right? These papers could be HBO or something more aggressive, something a little more adult, something a little more risk-taking. And for a lot of journalists, that made an attractive place to go try to start a career.
You know, for people, I think, especially who kind of built this alt weekly model, they and the people who worked in it at the high level, I don't think they really understood how abnormal this was, and that this was a moment in history that was so completely unique. Nothing like that had ever really been done before, and it was fleeting with the rise of Craigslist and social media.
I think that's right. I think we got a good, 40-year run out of it, and which I was lucky enough to grab a little piece of, and a lot of my co-creators too. We were of a generation that could look backward, enjoy the heyday, really the peak. We were there at the financial peak of alternative weeklies, and maybe the cultural peak. And I think as the internet atomized journalism in different ways, the cultural need for a paper that did the things that those papers did also kind of dispersed, right? Like, they were very aggressive about covering music and culture and food. Well, I mean, that's TikTok now, right? That's Instagram. There's so many people who have become experts on those sorts of things in their cities. You no longer need a newspaper to be the arbiter of where to go on a date this weekend, right? You don't need to pick up the paper to find concert listings or movie listings. I mean, Think about the days where, like, you didn't know what movies were playing.
You got Fandango, you got Yelp, you've got, you know,
all of it, right?
Like, or even in your Maps app. Yeah.
It's like it really is like the internet took apart the departments of weekly newspapers, daily papers too, but just focusing on weeklies. It took that apart, and people who just loved those subject areas, I kind of just started doing them. I mean, let's take Craigslist, right? Craig Newmark, sometime, I don't know when he moved to San Francisco, but he was in the Bay Area in the early 90s and was new to town, and people had given him recommendations on where to go see shows, what bars to hang out in, or whatever he was into at the time. He got those recommendations from people. And so he decided, man, I now know the city well enough. I want to give my own recommendations on this stuff. So he started Craigslist of basically just like stuff to do around the Bay Area. And it came out of a generous spirit. I think we've all had people visit us in a certain town and they say, where do we go? And they say, like, all right, well, here's my top 10 recommendations. Well, he was kind of doing that on a rolling basis. And as he got a large enough subscriber list, he gave it a more formal structure and kind of operationalized it and then built on this classified site, which turned into a literal website of world historic importance in what it did to publishing in America. But it came out of that same impulse, right? It's like, I know some cool stuff. I know people are looking for cool stuff. I'm just going to tell them what I think is cool and start this conversation. And so I think that writ by everybody who has a publishing platform now was always going to make it really tough for papers to exist, because so much of what we got to do there was lead a conversation, and now a lot more people can lead a lot more conversations. And there are drawbacks to that, and there are benefits to that, but it was a completely different time for understanding a city, understanding what there was to do and who had a say. It's completely changed, you're right.
Yeah. Well, and in addition to that, at the sort of cultural level, it also definitely was the case that this was a unique model in terms of what it did for dating and sex and things like that. I mean, you talked about it a little bit earlier, but, you know, the idea that, because, I mean, obviously, there's a reason people call prostitution the world's oldest profession, So people have always done it, and they did it before the alt weekly, but doing it became a lot safer, a lot, you know, more manageable for people. They could pre-screen their clients. This was not something that somebody who was just working by themselves really could ever do back in the day, unless they were really experienced at it. And so with the rise of the adult ads in these papers, and then later within Backpage and, you know, some of the other and dating websites, I mean, this was something completely different. But the other thing that I think is interesting and unique about the sex ad in the alt paper is that these were ads, you were interacting with someone, but it was only based on their, like, now you look at whether it's Tinder, Bumble, whatever it is, you know, it's about the first thing you see is a picture of the person. And that tells you nothing really about who they are, not really. And so it's, whereas with with these classified ads, you could actually see how somebody thought. And that was the only thing you could see about them was that. I mean, what's your thought?
I think that's, yeah, there's a few vectors there that I will admit. So I never dated via classifieds, right? I'm at that generational cusp where I was earning a salary from that, but I was never my dating scene. So in the course of reporting the show, I had to go back and ask people who did use classifieds, right? And there are a lot of different ways, a lot of different entry points. But one couple who I found in San Francisco who got married based on ads that they placed in the 90s, Ed and Lisa, I went to their home and I asked them, hey, how did this work? What was it? And the way they did it, which I think was a common model at the time, right? And there are certainly, like, there are different degrees of classifieds. Let's just be clear, in the way that there are adult dating sites versus just dating sites, right? There are certainly a myriad of different dating apps these days that have different levels of sort of, that have different cultures, right? Different cultures, different expectations of what you're going to find and what people are going to be into based on what you can assume, what, you know, where they are. And I think the same was true for placing a personal ad in a paper. So Ed and Lisa found each other through the mutual appreciation of a paper called the San Francisco Bay Guardian, which was a competitor to New Times in San Francisco. And back then, you could place an ad in the personals section, and the personal section would, as you say, have just some writing about yourself, right? It would probably list some, if it tell people how old you are, it would tell people your gender, your race, your age, usual things. You might reveal your educational background. You might say what sort of industry or field you work in. And then you would want to, yeah, I think, be charming in a small space. Sometimes the way to be charming is to say you're 6'4", right? That's fine. Or the way to be charming is to say you have an athletic build and you really enjoy a certain like exercise or pastimes that, you know, you want to find somebody who's a surfer, like just say you're a surfer, right? Whatever that is. And in the case of Ed and Lisa, Lisa placed the ad and she kind of had her like charming patter. And then go into the models that no longer exist. People who wanted to respond to that ad called a number, and it was like $1 a minute or $1.50 a minute, and you left a voicemail for Lisa, right? So if I read Lisa's ad, and I'm like, man, Lisa seems really cool, I don't get to swipe right on her and hope that she hits me back, right? I have to pay money to call 900 number at the time, leave a voicemail, it's going to charge my credit card, and in that, and this is what happened with Ed. Ed called. He had been a college radio DJ in his day. He had a very good voice and was very charming on his message. He mentioned that he was tall. I think he's 6'4", and that he would tell him that he looked like Jeff Goldblum. And this is the early 90s, and that, you know, early 90s Jeff Goldblum, 6'4", with a radio DJ voice is pretty good. So he leaves his message and Lisa calls him back. But what she was telling me was that once she placed the ad, and I don't know what she paid for that, if anything, the Bay Guardian just ran that ad for as long as she left it in, because probably people are reading it and they're like responding to it. And as long as the ad is in the paper and people are calling the number, that's where they're getting the money. But that was the old model, was you had to pay to try to court this, you know, this anonymous person who you only know through 40 words of type or something. I don't know what it was. It was short. And then you would call and leave the voicemail. So a little bit about people. And the way that I think if you're on Tinder, Bumble, Hinge, whatever, like, you know a little bit. And you just sort of hope that you bring your best self and that whatever's the little bit that you can reveal in that small space, somebody else responds to. So it was very much, I think, kind of a progenitor to that dance, but in a very different way. And you're right. Without an image of somebody, you really have to, you have to charm people with other wiles, right? You have to have, bring other stuff to the table.
Yep. Yeah. And then there was also a genre, and you guys did talk about it in the show also, that there was the sort of the spotted type of classified personal ad where people would essentially proclaim their infatuation with someone that they saw somewhere in a random moment. And like, that sort of thing is gone now, I think. But for those who aren't familiar with that, tell us about those.
I used to love this on Craigslist. So as a sort of a sidebar to this, Craigslist used to run personals. They no longer do. Craigslist dropped out of that game amid the pressure that Backpage stirred up. Craigslist was also in the crosshairs of Congress. And whereas Backpage basically said, come at me, bro, Craigslist was like, peace, too much heat, we're getting out of this game. But Craigslist used to have the most fun read anywhere, I thought, were the missed connections, right? It's what you're talking about, which is usually, I was riding the crosstown bus, or I was in line at this coffee shop, or I was riding my bike, and I saw this amazing person, and we had this tiny interaction, and it's this kind of letter in a bottle that somebody just throws into the ocean. It's the internet of whatever city, and they say, you were wearing this, you were about this tall, you said this to me, I said this to you, I should have gotten your number, and let's get together. And it feels like those are usually written by guys, but they were this wonderful, I don't know, sort of like subgenre of like interior monologues that people were having all over the city. And you really got to see what people wish they'd said in the moment. Or maybe there was a reason they couldn't say what they wanted to say, or they tried something and it didn't quite work, or whatever. But you really got to sort of see inside people's hopes romantically and people's regrets, oddly, right? Like, it's an instant regret situation where you say, oh man, I should have, why didn't I just, oh, if I'd only, oh, I could have. And as a genre, those have been around a long time. Those were in The Village Voice for years. There was the Madonna movie from the 80s, Desperately Seeking Susan, was kind of based on some of the same premises in those ads, right? So those have been around a long time, but I think you're right. They're pretty much gone these days. I follow at least one Instagram account, I can't remember what it's called, that does that in New York, that there are still misconnections, partly because they're so entertaining, which is the other part of what made Classified such a strong component of these papers for so long. They're entertaining. You read that, you pick it up, and you want to, it's like, it would be like looking inside of somebody, like the city's Tinder profiles, and you're just kind of like scanning these, and what are people doing to try to find each other? What are the risks that they're taking, which is always part of dating, always part of trying to find somebody, is like taking a risk of some kind, right? And when you see people walking through like, oh, I should have taken more of a risk, I should have put myself out there, here's who I am, here's who I know you are, you're out there. And I can tell you a story. So I actually did, this is years ago, but I loved reading those so much. And I was always so frustrated that people didn't just like walk up to somebody and start a conversation. And so I actually placed a misconnection for myself in the misconnections. I was like, I was in New York, I was like 26 years old. I was like, look, I don't understand why nobody talks to anybody. I'm going to be at the Natural History Museum. I look like this. I'm going to be walking around this time. Come up and talk to me if you see me, right? I've placed like a preview misconnection for people. And I ended up not even going to the museum. I was like too sleepy and lazy that day. But somebody wrote me back. This woman, her name is Heather, and she was a cook in New York. And she said, hey, this was really funny. I have the same reaction to these. I won't make it to the museum, I'm sorry. But I invited her to a house party. And we ended up dating for a little while because I was like, hey, you seem cool, like come to this party. And she did. And then here we were in New York, right? And so I think that was the one like weirdly successful wormhole I went through on a misconnection to actually connect with somebody. But it was it came out of that shared sense of like, are you people kidding? Like, step up and ask her her name, man.
Yeah. Well, and it's something that's lost, and it's worth remembering it or knowing about it if you never heard
of
it. There was a political component as well to these papers that we're talking about as well, that as you were saying, that a lot of the sort of family papers, as you guys refer to them, the general interest newspaper like the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Kansas City Star, et cetera, Miami Herald, they had certain strictures on them, editorially speaking, that in many ways we're kind of seeing a recapitulation of that with the Republican Party nationally having gone so completely insane that a lot of the national press or organizations, they are afraid to say that and afraid to tell the full truth about the Republican Party. But this is a dynamic that has always existed ever since the invention of mainstream journalism, quote unquote, and the idea of objectivity as a business proposition. And it was always absurd because, of course, believed it necessarily, especially if it was about something that they knew about. I think everybody's had that experience, that when you know about something, that a field that you work in or something that you have as a really big hobby, and you read about it in publications, a lot of times you'll be like, nah, that's wrong, or that's not fair, or whatever it is. So it was always a flawed model, but you know, it's collapsing on itself, I think, on the national scale. But you know, the alt weeklies kind of, they expose that on the local level as well.
Yeah, there's always a component of language policing that we all do with ourselves all the time, every day, at scale, at a business, the kind of business that a daily wanted to be, which is essentially a monopoly in town, right? They want to be the one-stop shop, but they also wanted to be, for the most part, inoffensive, right? I think if you ever read a daily paper, the place where you see that attitude, I think, carried out the most is with the comics. If you read the funny pages, whatever it was, most newspaper comics really suck. They are so boring. They're not funny. They're really just pretty much like the definition of content, as this kind of regurgitated stuff that you open it up and you're like, oh yeah, that's what Beetle Bailey's doing today. It's not funny. And then you think of underground comics, right? Underground comics are so dynamic and so lively and so alive and so weird and funny and maybe sexy and dark and touch upon human experience in this way that like the kind of the stuff served up in the paper every day is like, just isn't. I think you can certainly amplify that out and say, yeah, there were just, you didn't want to offend people in certain ways. The phrase that you'd always hear working at dailies, and I started my career at dailies and I went to a journalism school at Northwestern that was oriented toward the culture of dailies. And so part of the culture of dailies is people are going to read this over breakfast. Imagine a person who doesn't want to be hit with a certain level of like sexuality or profanity or graphic violence or whatever are the things that could put somebody off as they eat their grapefruit and drink their coffee, right? You're writing for that person, a person who in the sort of like imagination of the paper is a person easily offended who might cancel their subscription or write an angry letter or call the publisher, whatever's going to happen. And so most of what you're there to do is like not rock the table. Some news is just going to be scary or off-putting. Like that's just the way news is. But so much of what the paper coached internally reporters to do and editors to think about is like, don't offend anybody needlessly, right? But like, okay, like life is hard and there's a ton of things that we talk about, a ton of subjects we don't talk about that can hit people the wrong way. And if you're never going to put yourself in a position to be disturbed, well, you're going to have a view of reality that's just a little warped, right? And I think that kind of self-policing is a big danger of what you're talking about. If you say... I think now, certainly, there's a lot of the culture war, a lot of the sort of left-right fight over reality comes down to what words do we use? What comes down to, I mean, just it's just extraordinary to me how much mileage the sort of like tut tut right has gotten out of pronouns, right? And I think really the strategy there is to say, you're policing our language, so we're going to police your language. And it becomes this weird like mirror upon mirror effect. But I think that battlefield has been really opened up, partly because people don't read the dailies anymore. The dailies just don't exist, and because they kind of moderated things, right? And I don't mean moderate in terms of like a debate moderation, but it was a place that moderates had really the stage, right? And I think we have removed moderates from a lot of the content and a lot of the media that we absorb. And so what we get are people who are really pissed off on both sides, feeding algorithms that feed us more of that. And so we're back to having language wars when a lot of it was just kind of, it was understood, like you use certain language, you didn't use certain language. Whereas at New Times, we got to use certainly in quotes, right? A lot more profanity and a lot more color in the language than we would ever get away with in the daily. And it was really fun, but it also helped you capture life as it happened and not pretend everything was PG rated when life isn't.
And the other interesting thing about alt weeklies is that they were conceived in sort of this moment where libertarians, they saw themselves as on the left, and that they were anti-conservative. And basically, essentially what happened is that a lot of things that were perceived as countercultural, such as being openness to drugs or like supporting marijuana legalization or supporting prostitution legalization or being in favor of comedians saying profanities on stage.
Access
like
to
that.
Abortion, right? Access to abortion is a big one.
Abortion. Yeah. And so those things became mainstream. And so essentially, libertarianism bifurcated and joined up with its right-wing origins. And some of that story played out in the alt-weekly world as well, right?
I think that's right. I think what used to be countercultural split, and in some ways it won, right? Like, we now...
Yeah.
It's not like... I wasn't alive in the early 70s, but from all accounts, oh my gosh, there was just no recognition that anything but heterosexuality was the default mode that everybody was issued upon birth, and we just didn't talk about anything else, right? And it wasn't until the Stonewall riot, which literally happened across the street from the old Village Voice office, and the Voice, which was not particularly progressive on this particular issue, they were kind of an old straight boys club like everybody else at the time. They looked out their window, watched this like gay bar blow up and get into a riot with the cops, and are like, "Wes, we have to go cover this, and we have to discuss this issue. We have to talk about civil rights for people who aren't this sort of like nuclear family from the 50s that everybody had been kind of like boxed in by." I think you're right. There wasn't a shattering in a way, and I think though strangely we're coming back to it. Right, it's coming back around in this way that. It felt like many of the reasons for there to be a counterculture eventually won the day. I think drug laws, certainly compared to the 70s, are far less draconian nationwide. That's changing very slowly, but man, what a difference between now and when I was a kid. I mean, to think that today in New York City, like, they basically just don't prosecute marijuana possession, and to think of the untold lives wrecked by that before over basically a Nixon era campaign against people he didn't like. I mean, is a big sea change, right? But now we're back to, for instance, Arizona reviving its 160-year-old abortion law that Roe v. Wade had tamped down. We're back in the Civil War. I mean, literally, we're back in Civil War days if you want healthcare. And before 50 years before women could vote, and that's where we are, right?
And yeah, you're also seeing it like in Florida with these book ban laws. Like,
right.
The Republicans went back to it. Right. And then largely it is because the libertarian let them do it. that's really what I think happened, and they need to wake the fuck up is what I would say.
Well, I think it's funny because I made this joke talk with my co-producers on this, is for a long time, I think in recent years, libertarians and the religious right have been sort of linked arms, right, in places like Texas. But I think they're both going to be really unhappy if either of them gets what they want, right? If libertarians really get what they want, like, the religious right's going to be pissed off. And if the religious right gets what they want, true libertarians, and I don't think there are that many, frankly, true libertarians, I think they're going to be pissed off. There's this politics weird, strange bedfellows and all that. But certainly, I think if people were ideologically consistent libertarians instead of this sort of like authoritarians in sheep's clothing, as I think a lot of libertarians have proven to be, they would be consistent on things like government interference in your personal life, including who you marry, who you have sex with, if it's consenting adults, can you advertise that you are a person who is going to have sex with people? Can you do it for money? All of that would seemingly be things libertarians would be in favor for. But I think what we find is libertarianism these days, as it exists, mostly belongs to men. And most of it isn't really ideologically consistent with anything except laws that certain men want to see put into play, frankly.
To benefit themselves.
Oh, yeah, or just to benefit their glandular response to the world. I mean, I don't even think it's really consistent. I don't think there is a benefit. There's not a benefit to most men for women not to be able to access healthcare and get an abortion. This is like, it's like, guys, have you played this out on your checkerboard of life? Like, what happens if sex becomes life-threatening to people? Do you think you're gonna have more sex or less sex? And it stuns me to see the zeal with which men in particular, want to clamp down on women's behavior and to imagine the world that they think they're going to inherit when they're successful with that. It's not a good one. It's not one that is going to make you happy. It's not going to be peaceful. It's not going to be enjoyable. And yet here we are. We're fighting these fights without, in some ways, like, without the sense of history or without the sense of place that I think, frankly, good local journalism can provide and help ground people in a shared reality.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, and that is definitely a thing that's missed, is that as these conversations and different topics have sort of bifurcated into their own realms, the things that people, like, let's say if you were primarily interested in reading an Alt Weekly for the music reviews or the restaurant reviews, like, that was why you picked it up. But you would still look at these other things because they were there and it was easy, right? But now if you're somebody who's just like a hardcore foodie, or you're dedicated to two or three, you know, musical groups or whatever, you can look at only those things and you don't have to see anything else, and you don't get educated about any other issue or any other topic. And it really has, I think that's kind of a dilemma that Joe Biden is in right now. That I think a lot of people who, I mean, when you ask Americans in polls, do you support same-sex marriage, or do you support birth control, do you support marijuana legalization, any of these variety of things that has a vast majority of support, many of the people who have those viewpoints have no idea that there is a party that is trying to take those things away from you. They want to take your contraception. They want to take your right to get an abortion. They're going to do it. They're going to make your kids pray in their fashion in school. These are their goals, and they don't even know that this is happening because they don't have any exposure to media.
I think there's also a sense, just along those lines, I think there's a sense of, well, that's not really going to happen. Well, okay, yes, it can. It totally can. It has in the past. I think there were a lot of people who never thought Roe would be overturned, partly because it was so good for the Republican base to never be able to get to the end of something, right? It was this telenovela you would always tune into. Yeah. The Republicans are like, tune in next week with your donation dollars as we try to overturn abortion. Everybody's like, man, they just keep making all kinds of money off this. And then the historical strangeness of the Trump administration getting to install 3 judges in 4 years bites everybody on the ass. And you say, no, these guys were serious. Like, They were serious. Yeah. And I think it would be folly not to take them to at their word. I think it is more, certainly seems more real than it had been for a long time. The idea that really fundamental questions of American democracy and American rights, things that we had been conditioned to expect, yeah. could be overturned. And in fact, there wouldn't be a place to go to really appeal that. That wouldn't be like a do-over. It's a bit like Brexit, right? I think there were a lot of people in the UK who were like, we're not really going to do this, right? Like, we're not serious. And then you see...
I don't have to vote on it. Yeah.
You watch these, yeah, or like, this just isn't a big deal. And then it passes, barely. And then you see the news stories the next day about how many Google searches there were in the UK for what is Brexit, right? And I think we're at that point where it's like, wait, what is contraception? Like, we're not going to have contraception? Like, that just doesn't compute with people. And I think there are, and this isn't my area of expertise at all, but I think there are a lot of journalists who are working really hard right now to try to do those stories that get beneath the surface of what certain political leaders' true religious backgrounds are and what they might ascribe to and what they might do. And it's way more serious than I think a lot of people have given it credit for. And I come at it from the journalism world. I think we should have more coverage of the results of elections. I think that'd be terrific. I also think we live in a country where, because of the Electoral College, there are really only about 10 states every 4 years that decide the presidential election. We have been conditioned to just not really participate in ways that I think really benefit the kinds of people and the kinds of aims that you're describing. Because truly, it just does not matter if most of us participate. And that's so deeply structural, it will never change in our lifetimes. And that, I think it's the well, frankly, and like what we can ever expect to change through political action or political attention, we may as well just like watch TV and go about our lives. It's going to be very hard to turn those things back if they flip.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, so just now to go back to the story you guys are telling with the, so Craigslist comes along and destroys the newspaper industry, basically. And a lot of that is their own fault because executives, they thought that this was forever what they were doing. They didn't realize it was anomaly. And they thought you could get away running a business with 20 or 30% profits forever. When no business was like that, almost like from literally no business other than a few years time span, industry will last that long with that kind of money. Just is no, never happens, never happens. And these guys, they just sat on their ass and their business was taken away from them by their own negligence. And so, and that was also the case with the New Times guys, as you guys talk about, that they knew Craigslist was out there, but they didn't really pay too much attention to it. And until it kind of, it completely destroyed the alt weekly business. So then, as you said, they went over and started Backpage. And Backpage, and I have to say, like, Backpage in its heyday, it was very important for sex workers to be able to get a living and in a way that was safe for them. And I mean, you want to talk about that aspect for a little bit here, if you
would. Yeah. So that's, I think, so I'm not a person who ever used Backpage or used, I don't know, like, to me, and I think I was a little naive in my 20s and 30s, but working on a show like this, you sort of start to see like, oh yeah, this was more of a thing. People would just really advertise like sexual services, and it would be online, and people would reply to that, and then they would go exchange money, and they'd have sex, and the world would keep turning, and Backpage would keep a little piece of it and take an even smaller piece of that and give it to newspapers to keep them running. What's so wild to me about what Backpage did, from people that we talked to making this story and sex workers that we quizzed about it, they all really liked it. And it was such a contrast talking to people who advertised on Backpage or used Backpage or who were sex workers. And it might not be prostitution. It could be, It could be running a dungeon. It could be, there are a lot of different things that people advertise for. So I don't want to say it was like all prostitution. It wouldn't be the case. But the public perception was of a place of a lot of danger. And there were terrible things that happened out of the ads that people placed in Backpage and on Craigslist. As, look, I mean, you get millions of people connecting, and a lot of them are expecting sex, or people get into sexual situations for power dynamics, and you know, when people got killed, we don't want to minimize that one bit, right? But it was a very small number compared with the millions and millions of ads that were going up. And what sex workers told us was that in those days where they could advertise more or less in the open, as Backpage gave them the opportunity to do, that gave them control of the market in a way that they didn't have when they were advertising in more clandestine ways, right? So if you were advertising your services on Backpage, you might have, because it was so available and open and obvious and just easy to access for anybody, you might get dozens or hundreds of replies from your ad. Well, you don't have to accept dozens or hundreds of people as your clients or your customers or, you know, whoever, whatever term you want to use in this, your date. You can sift through that. You can be really picky. You can find people who have a good reputation among other people who are in your same business. You can vet aggressively. You don't have to take the first guy who shows up at your door, whatever that is. And so for a lot of people who were using Backpage, they felt like they had more control, they had more safety, and they had a better sort of social network that they could use to regulate, self-regulate the marketplace than they had without it. When it went away, the description that we got from one sex worker advocate was that it was total chaos, right? It was a lot of fear, and it was a lot of income lost, and it was a big scramble. And what came immediately afterwards for women who were advertising on Backpage were men who wanted essentially to be like managers or pimps or whatever term you want to use, people who said like, hey, I can help you find clients now. Well, listen, man, like, pimps suck. Like, we shouldn't glorify pimps. Pimps are not, like, in a perfect world, we would not have people who take a cut of dangerous and in many cases extremely personal profession with the threats of violence, the threats of like financial imbalance, everything that comes with that. Taking Backpage away, at least we were told, our reporting on this, really put a lot of women in what they felt was a precarious position, which was, again, as I say, kind of a fascinating perspective on it. Because if you follow the congressional hearings, if you looked at what the FBI wanted to say, what the feds have said, it really is this, like, even in the federal trial, many of these ads were brought in as evidence. And the term that the federal government used, that prosecutors used, was victims. These are victims on Backpage. It's like, I don't really see a victim here. I see somebody who's putting a picture of themselves in a low-cut shirt on the internet. We could argue about the merits of that or whether that should be legal or any number of approaches to that. But to call that person a victim who placed their own ad and is saying, like, come over and spend time with me and pay me money and then we'll go our separate ways. Victim seems to me a bit over the line, right? I think it's rounding up in this situation. But it was the perspective of the government that people advertising on Backpage were being exploited.
Criminals or victims.
Yeah, we're being exploited. And so it's like, and therefore the people running Backpage were criminals, running basically a criminal enterprise. And it really, I think, calls, if you really go into it, it really calls into questions a lot of assumptions we have about the place of sex work and advertising sex work in American society.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, I mean, numerically, if you look at people making these similar types of ads on, or let's say posts, we'll call them, making posts of this nature, there's a lot more of them on Facebook. There's a lot more of them on Twitter or Instagram. I mean, that is the reality. Like, there are a lot of people who are sex workers who are ply their trade on Instagram or, you know, somewhere else. But the fact that it's a lower percentage of the post That's really the only difference between what's going on here.
I will tell you one other difference. Facebook is a giant company. New Times was small. Twitter is a giant company. New Times didn't have the pockets. They couldn't defend themselves in the same way. And I think we've always, as Americans, have accepted that there's going to be some level of discourse or advertising that talks about prostitution or sexual services. I mean, I wasn't kidding earlier. It used to be in the Yellow Pages. Like, there used to be escort, when there were Yellow Pages, back when people, there were a lot of escort ads in big cities, which I didn't know or realize because I grew up in a town too small to have escort sections of the Yellow Pages. But there's always been that presence, and it has always been sort of a like marginal, like, look, it's like, who's this really hurting? We can't police this fully. Just let it go kind of thing. But I do think when people advertise on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or whatever platform people are using, big platform, regulated platform, a really big difference between those platforms and what New Times and Backpage represented is just scale and size and power. And these guys were of the correct size that they had built this big marketplace with a lot of people using, millions of people placing ads. But they weren't a public company. They weren't a multi-billion-dollar company. They were a very good size to like shoot down, mount their heads on the wall, and move along. They didn't have to pick apart Meta, right? They didn't have to pick apart Twitter X, whatever it is. Like,
well, and they also didn't have the political connections as well, because
totally. And their business for years was just pissing off. They just pissed off
the
politicians.
Opposite.
Absolutely the opposite, right? And they would tell it. And it's hard to. This is the kind of thing. It's hard to verify, and so it's hard for me to make the claim in full. But if you talk to these guys, they would say absolutely there's a political motive. Their old political enemies for years, which in the case of Lacey and Larkin, John McCain, Cindy McCain, his wife, were for years, since the 80s, very much in the sights of their publications, specifically in Phoenix New Times. And they would say that a lot of this is politically motivated retaliation for years of thwacking the hell out of them every time they got a chance, which is the danger of being an impolite, impolitic, aggressive news organization. If you start a giant hooker ad website, people might come and put a gun in your face.
Find a way to put you out of business.
And throw you in jail, right? Like, this is the story that we got into, and it is crazy to think about it in those terms, but there is a version of the world in which they were more, let's say, political, or just say maybe even obsequious to power, in which they still get to run this website. But they were not. They were really confrontational in a way that I think very few news organizations had that same ethic of just relentless scrutiny of what they saw as powerful people and their actions, right? So I think all of that rolls up over, oh my gosh, 30 years, 40 years of pissing off everybody you can. That comes home to roost eventually, and I think it does in the story that we told.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting also that this is a bipartisan effort that happened to them as well, and you guys talk about that, and that, but this is another example of how I think that it is very possible for people who strongly disagree with the Christian right's authoritarian morality system still be manipulated to do what they want. And that's kind of what happened with Kamala Harris when she was the Attorney General of California. Like, she was the one who kind of got this ball rolling. And you want to talk about that?
Yeah, she was one. So there really were, I remember writing this section of the script, because this all is in the recent past, and I had to go through and it's like, what did happen? Once it got to Congress, which is in 2017, once Lacey and Larkin were hauled in front of Congress, they had hearings essentially around accusations that Backpage had facilitated a lot of pretty unsavory crimes, some of them involving minors. I think it became very clear in sort of a preview, I think, today of a lot of political discourse that goes online talking about like groomers, or we talk about book bans. In 2017, it was child sex trafficking, right? And I think it's pretty clear now that a lot of the numbers that advocates and politicians were using at the time to try to illustrate the size of that particular problem, which is a nightmare if it's happening to people, were way, 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 way overblown, right? It just was not anywhere near the scope and scale of what people thought might be happening, because there are some very terrible real cases that throw a long shadow over everything else that's happening. But once it got to Congress, it became absolutely a bipartisan for Democrats, for Republicans. I think Kamala Harris is a great example because she is a Democrat, now the VP. But she's also a cop. She was a cop in California. I should say this is sort of like loose terms, but she was, as the head law enforcement agent in California, she was the person who worked with Ken Paxton in Texas, who was a top cop in Texas, basically. And they both said, linking arms, kumbaya, Texas and California, these guys have got to go. We're arresting these guys. And so Lacey and Larkin went to Sacramento. They were put in a cage. And so they're in like orange jumpsuits in a cage. I think Lacey compares it to Cairo in the podcast when we interviewed him about it. And 2 weeks before her Senate election, right, she's got these big fish on the hook in a courtroom in California that plays well. And I think Democrats, look, I think Democrats always, I think back to the crime bill, Bill Clinton's 1990s, right? Democrats love to, in some ways, overcorrect on law and order because they think it gives them a defense against Republicans. I think what ultimately happens, though, is Republicans will call Democrats squishes no matter what happens. But Democrats, at least in my lifetime, have often pushed very hard and been real avatars for like strong crackdowns on things that are seen to have a marginal value, right, or affecting a case like this, which is, you know, advertising for sexual services. There just aren't a lot of people who raise their hand and say, tell you know what, like, I actually think we should have more freedom to run hooker ads. Like that constituency is probably pretty large, but also it's very quiet compared with how exciting it can be to bust people of ill repute for whatever it is. And by the time it got to Congress in 2017, and they were debating the laws that eventually got passed, FOSTA SESTA, that would change the way that the internet is regulated and make it such that a website such as Backpage just won't ever exist again in the US in the way that it was conceived. It was almost lockstep. It was almost perfect. Democrat, Republican, hand in hand, voting to pass these laws that really changed the way the internet can work. And it happened to be a very ideologically conservative, by historical standards, House and Senate, but they were absolutely not passing many, many bills of that size with that like-mindedness, right? These are we live in very divided political times, and there was no division on this. Republicans, Democrats, yeah. I'm sure there were, if I looked through who voted against them, like there may be some really truly committed social libertarians who didn't think it was a good way to go, but mainstream, man, they were all about it for sure.
It's also that it's hard to have a concept of that freedom of speech has, you know, it should protect things that might make you uneasy in the same, but at the same point, like people were also like, people haven't drawn the distinction, I think, between advocating for violent overthrow of the government is something in other words, there are more limits that people want on that, and justifiably so, than if somebody wants to advertise their dominatrix website or whatever it is. Right, yeah. Like, that's not really hurting anybody if someone wants to be paid to go on a date.
I think that's the thing that we really have to, as grownups, look at and say, I think that is exactly where to start, is like, look, man, who's it hurting? And I think there are definitely ways in which people pressure minors into sexual situations, and that's gross. And if there's a hell people like that belong there. But most of the minors who get caught up in what you, I think, would be called outside prostitution or street prostitution, mostly are, I was told by leading expert on this in this area, are people who are thrown out of their home, often because they are gay, right? There are just a lot of families in which a kid is in an abusive or bad situation. They have to leave home early. Maybe they're 15, 16, I don't know, and or younger, and they go out, and now they have to make money. And there are people who take advantage of that, and it's pretty bad times, right? But, so big asterisk on that, right? I condemn Hamas. Like, that's that part of that conversation. But when it comes to people who want to have sexual experiences with somebody else, I think it is a very natural, and if it's done in a civil way, probably mutually beneficial and for them and for the world, for them to come to an agreement and say, look, I'm going to pay for your time, and I am looking to do this that either I've always wanted to try, I can't do it with my partner, don't have a partner for it, it's always been something I want to experience, and look, man, we're all dead for a long time. Like, everybody should go have the consensual fun you want to have on this ride around on this rock, because we're not coming back. If you leave it on the table, that's where it's going to stay. We talked with a guy. So I have friends who are sex workers. I went to one of them and I said, hey, I need to find a client. I need to find somebody who has paid for sexual services to be in the show. And a friend of mine said, okay, I know a guy. She's a dominatrix. She said, I'll put you in touch with this guy. His name is John. I interviewed him. He appears in the podcast as an actor because he really didn't want people to recognize him. And so we took the transcript of the conversation. We gave it to an actor. Actor reads it. But the story John told me was, I thought, pretty damn crazy, because he had years earlier discovered via advertisement in the local paper in the city that he lived, a dungeon. I think it was under a head shop, right? It was something where it was like very weird language, and he went in, and it was probably a place where you could buy bongs and stuff. And he wound up in this dungeon, and he had, I guess what you'd call, this is where my expertise sort of starts to falter, but he had what he would describe, I think, as a pain session. Probably he's restrained, probably somebody's whipping him. There's a safe word. He's experiencing things that he hasn't experienced before. And what he discovers about himself through, over the years, many such sessions, is that he has these different kind of sexual tastes and sexual predilections. And one thing that he discovered about himself is that only in these kinds of sessions where he has a safe word, where there is a professional there who is, I assume, just, I don't know, whipping him or whatever's going on, he can tap out of that. It's such a cathartic environment for him. He can't cry as an adult. And I think there's a lot of men who would be like, if you ask them, when was the last time you cried? They'd be like, couldn't tell you. He said only in those kinds of sessions are when he can access the part of himself that feels safe emotionally to release these big cathartic cries. And during the course of reporting this, when I'm kind of, he and I are messaging each other and we're trying to find a time when we can talk, he says at one point, we were supposed to meet at one point, he says, hey, my dad died, I have to cancel. And I said, I'm so sorry, we'll reschedule. When we talked again, he mentioned this about the crying, and he said, look, as my dad just died, by then it had been a couple weeks, I think. And he said, I haven't cried about that yet, but I have a pain session scheduled and I'm looking forward to a really big cry. And I was like, man, this is wild shit. This is a guy who, I think, if not to cast, there are people in this country who would say that's despicable. You shouldn't be able to advertise for this stuff. There shouldn't be dungeons. There shouldn't be a place where a man gets like tied up and hit with a whip or whatever's going on in there. And to them, I'd say like, yo, this is none of your business, but man, this guy needs to cry about his dad dying. And this is how he's going to access it. And he's going to leave it in a much better mood. And I think the world will be on balance, a better place. This is just the kind of stuff that I don't want to be in charge of regulating in other people's lives. I think that is like such a personal experience between him and between whoever he's paying for their time. And that's just one example. I mean, if you think about that, think about the complexity of what people access about themselves and can enjoy or decide they don't enjoy or whatever's happening through sex. It's kind of wild to think that you know better in every case than a guy who's making those choices for himself. Like, it really changed my perspective on this. And I'm pretty, speaking of libertarian, I'm pretty laissez-faire about that sort of thing, right? Like, if that's your jam, like, I want you to have access to it. I hope you tip well at the end of it. I have friends who have really made livings for parts of their lives doing sex work. And I think that is a mostly actually weirdly healthy economy for people to engage in within boundaries. And it would be so weird to me to take that away from him because it weirds me out or gives me the icks. Like, that's not my business. Like, that's not my, y'all do you, man. I'll do me. Y'all do you.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about this though, is that I think, you know, people who, again, like to go back to kind of this sort of squishy moderate person who doesn't agree with the Christian right, but they kind of feel that these people are icky. They make me uncomfortable. What they don't understand is that when you ally with the Christian right, not only are they going to abolish the sex dungeon or the adult ads, they're also going to get rid of psychotherapy. Because they hate that also. They want their one-size-fits-all agenda for you also. And that's why they have to be put in a box and not let out. Because they will impose their viewpoint. Look, because, again, like, you know, the rest of us, it doesn't affect us if somebody wants to go to some pastor and say, you know, be Ned Flanders. And say, you know, I feel like I sinned because I saw a woman on a billboard and it made me feel tingly and I feel bad about it. You know, like, that's, if that's your thing, look, hey, you go for it. But the rest of us will not be put in that box with you. Like, you can go put yourself in there, but that's a kink. You need to understand that. And
right, the box, you know, kink.
These guys, yeah. And this is not an exaggeration, because like in the state of Iowa, for instance, right now, the radical Republican legislators there are trying to replace school counselors who have been trained to help children with their psychological and emotional needs. They're replacing them with completely untrained pastors. And this is a state law that they want. And Republicans nationwide, they will do this if people let them. Like, you might not like the sex ads or, you know, the adult entertainment or whatever, but they're the frontier keeping you away from these people, controlling your life. Like, that's the reality.
I think there is some of that. Yeah, that recognition needs to happen, which is, look, going to a dungeon, getting whipped, having a good cry, that's not my scene. But if I were to take the position that made me feel a little icky, and I don't mind if you crack down on that, right? Yeah, the line, like, that slope, it is slippery. Like, it goes a long way. There are just certain matters that are best left to people who are living those lives and have that experience. I grew up in a religious part of the country, and I in Northwest Arkansas, and sort of developed a bit of skepticism and hostility even at times to the Christian position on these things. But it was at the time, it was very separate, right? There were churches in town. There were certainly religious organizations and institutions and viewpoints on things, but we didn't have to pray in school. I didn't have to go, if I had a problem at school, talk to a pastor, right? Like, no, thank you. What is that guy? No, like, I don't want to, that's not what that's there for. What is there for that is there's a church, there's a place you can go and do that. And I do think it is, yeah, I think it's a responsibility of full-grown adults to make good choices based not on how each one individually makes us feel for ourselves, but to consider the breadth of human experience and make sure that people's different needs and different inclinations can be met safely and responsibly, right? I mean, it seems really easy if you boil it down to that, but then you think oh, there are just some other people who would really rather they be in charge of your life than you.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so in terms of the two subjects of the podcast, they had a mistrial in 2022.
Like, what's the status of their situation?
Well, not to spoil the podcast, but so we did. We worked on this show really for 4 years, right? From the time we started, these guys were arrested in 2018. Big news at the time. And it was in 2020, kind of everybody's in lockdown and trying to come up with ideas of things to do. We got Trevor Aronson, Michael Mooney, and me got together and said, we should do this show, right? We should do this podcast. We should do the full story of what's happening with Backpage. At the time, yes, there was this trial scheduled that kept getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back and eventually happened in 2022. We didn't yet have a deal, 2021. We didn't yet have a deal to do the podcast. And I was losing my mind. I was like, God, if only we'd been quicker, if this were easier, if we all worked at Vice or something, we could be doing this. But we didn't. We're all independent, and things move slow. But it was a very quick mistrial, and it was a mistrial for reasons that I think are very consistent with a lot of the rest of the show. Essentially, the government was making repeated insinuations that there was a child sex trafficking angle or a sex trafficking angle to the case the government brought against Lacey and Larkin. In fact, there really wasn't. Those weren't the charges. It was a lot of what was discussed in public, but those weren't in the charges. And so the judge, after only a week or two of testimony, pulled the plug and basically said, look, the jury's been tainted. This has come up too much. It's a mistrial. For us, that was great because we weren't making the show yet. So we finally, in 2022, we make our deal with Audible. And so I think no matter where you are with him personally, and we talk to people who do not like these guys. If you listen to the show, plenty of people in there who were not fans of Lacey and Larkin would say this is still a tragic ending for two people who absolutely changed the course of American journalism, changed the course of American history, and it's a dark conclusion for a business and a life that so many of us led and have so many good memories out of and did amazing work from. But yeah, the two of them, I mean, look, we'll see. Lacey's strong, and I don't know what kind of sense he's going to get. There's a really good chance that when he comes out, he will still be as much, you know, piss and vinegar as he always has been. And I don't want to say that his chapter is yet finished, but from what we cover in the show, it's pointing to a hard landing for sure.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, that's been a great conversation, Sam.
So
for people who want to check it out, they should. They can get it on Audible.
You have to have a subscription, right?
Yeah, go to Audible. You can. The shortest way to get there is just audible.com/holdfast, one word. It is a subscription service. Podcasting's wild, but Audible keeps its originals close to the vest, so you do have to subscribe. I have been subscribing for a couple of years because I wanted to get familiar with the platform, but there are certainly, if you just like type in Audible, there are free trials. There's like 99 cents for 3 months if you're a first timer. It connects to your Amazon account. It's like pretty easy to get on there and listen to it if you want. You can do this one in a day if you are really so inclined. But yeah, I suggest checking it out if this is at all interesting, because I think we made a hell of a show, frankly. I worked with some really talented people, and we poured a gazillion hours into it. We had access that we would not have in any world had if we had not worked at the companies years and years ago and been welcomed into the homes of guys facing federal trial. Like, you just, like, I think they thought they were going to we would give them a fair shake, and I think we did. And it's certainly, I think the response we've gotten from the show so far from people in the media has been really positive, and yeah, so I feel very comfortable recommending it to just go for a ride. I mean, if I say it's a show about the alternative press, like, I'm sure everybody would fall asleep, but it's about that and sex, power, drugs, guns, and just some crazy stories that if they had not appeared in print, you would not believe they happened. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I think that is a accurate summation of it. And so for people who are listening and they want to follow you on social media, why don't you spell your last name for them?
Yeah, sure. Last name is Eifling, EIFLING, first name Sam. And I think I never really got more creative than just having a weird last name online. Pretty easy to find on that, all social handles. But yeah, thank you for the opportunity. This has been a fun conversation.
All right, so that is the program for today. I appreciate everybody joining us for the discussion. If you want to get more, you can go to theoryofchange.show, where you can get the video, audio, and transcript of all the episodes. And if you are a paid subscribing member, thank you very much for your support. You have unlimited access to all of the content. And you can also visit us over at flux.community. Theory of Change is part of the Flux Media Network, so go there and check us out. We got other podcasts and articles about politics, religion, media, and society, and how they all intersect. And I appreciate everybody supporting us. Tell your friends, tell your family. Hell, tell people you don't like about Theory of Change and Flux. I really appreciate it. Thanks very much, and I will see you next time.